The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Talk to us about protecting yourself from flu this winter at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Okay, every Friday we invite somebody into Studio 10 and we ask them to guide us through the soundtrack to their lives. And today's the turn of Brian D'Arcy. Now, I have FR written before your name here, but yes. On the cover of your new book, there's no FR, there's no father, it's just Brian D'Arcy.
Brian D'Arcy,
so
yeah.
What do you prefer?
If I'm doing a funeral, people call me Father Brian D'Arcy.
Yes.
And if I'm out around the street, nobody ever calls me Brian D'Arcy. Just Brian.
Right.
I'm going to shops, going to anywhere. It just seems to be, maybe it's because of this underworld, maybe it's because of, I don't know, people just like it maybe, and that's what it is, maybe.
And, do you like it being called?
Oh, I've no problem with it at all.
Yes.
In fact, I'd prefer to be called Brian.
Yeah.
Nothing against Father, but I don't like the titles like that, you know. First of all, if I'm not a human being, first of all, there's no point in putting a tag in front of me. That doesn't make me any different.
More special, yeah.
More special.
Yeah.
So I'd like to just to be, that's why I don't dress with a collar except when I'm on official business either. I haven't done for years on the official business. And that way, and you just go out and you're accepted as a human being. It just makes me think of being, you know, I don't have to put on an act. I'm myself, and I don't put on holy words and holy voices and holy things.
Which all sort of can create barriers between you and the people
hugely,
you're talking to.
Hugely, yes. Not, you know that the guy behind it is not real.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's trying to be just real. I may not always be as real as people would want me to be, but I'm as real as I can be.
Mm. We've loads of things to talk about.
Right.
Because I've read the book.
Well, thank you very much. It's very kind of you to read the book.
There's an awful lot in it, Brian.
There
an
is.
Awful lot in it. Mm. But as we do always on a Friday, we'll start with your date of birth.
Well, the date of birth is handy enough.
The 1st of June, 1945.
1945, that's it. Yeah.
Born to Hugh and Ellen D'Arcy.
That's right.
From Ballinlough, which is 5 miles outside Enniskillen.
Enniskillen, yeah.
Yeah, I looked it up. I looked it up on Google Maps.
Oh, yeah.
It's a pretty little village.
Gorgeous little village.
Yeah.
Excuse me. It used to be a very small little village. Now there's Enniskillen has grown a little bit as a result of it. And so, lo and behold, the field that I used to play football in is 100 houses on it.
Right, okay, right, so, yeah.
So that's what it is. But apart from that, it's beside Lough Erne. Right near there, and Culchie Mountains are just up the road. And if you haven't been on the Culchie Walk, you're a good walker like myself.
Yeah.
Culchie Walk's a brilliant walk. We have the Marble Arch Caves, you know, stalagmites for 3,500 years old, the stalactites, the same. In that area, that's all that little area of the place.
Which is which, stalagmites and stalactites? I can never remember.
Well, tights come down.
Do they? Because they're tight in the ceiling.
That's right, well, you know.
People have different ways of remembering which is which.
Tights come down is what they tell us.
Oh, no, tights come down. That's the Marble Arch Cages up in Ballinalec. So where were you in the family, and how many children were there?
There were four in the family. There was Marie, who's the eldest of the family, and then was my brother Gaby, God be good to him. He was 4 years older than me. He died at 70 years of age, died very suddenly, same as my father. Both of them died of heart attacks instantly, you know, in perfect working order, no warning about it at all, which is why I have three stents in, I suppose, myself at this stage.
You
have three stents in, yeah. Three stents in for about nearly 10 years now,
okay,
actually. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you don't...
No, never. I didn't even know then. It was just a routine check. And they said, you must have something wrong with you. Why? I said, no. They said, are you still running? Yes, I still run, yeah. And do you not feel pain? And do you not feel no? Nothing. I had no. I knew it was a heart attack. It was a heart attack waiting to happen. Actually.
Yes. So because they say what happens sometimes is fitness levels. If you're quite fit, it can sort of disguise underlying conditions.
Mm.
So that's what was happening with
that's
you.
That's what was happening to me. Yeah, exactly what was happening to me. And I was very lucky and had good friends who spotted it in a thing, who spotted it with a stethoscope test.
Right.
He said, there's something wrong there. He said, there's something wrong and I'm going to send you for the checks. And when I sent him for the checks, there was three of the arteries quite severely blocked.
Yeah. And no symptoms.
And I honestly had no symptoms. No. The nearest I had to a symptom, this is a strange thing. This is a second volume memoir. There was a volume 13 years ago called A Different Journey. And I was on the Late Late with Pat Kenny, who was doing it. And he asked me about something that night. I can't even remember what it was. But I found myself that I couldn't breathe.
Right.
Which is not normal for me, I began to be just not comprehensible even to myself, just for one question.
So there wasn't enough oxygen going to the brain just for that moment?
Just for that moment. Yeah. That is the only thing
right.
I can ever think of that I had. And I knew I was short of breath, and I knew I couldn't finish sentences because I was running out of breath, and I knew all that, but I could do nothing about it.
Right.
And that's
was anybody else aware of that, Brian?
No. Nobody's else. No.
And this is what's going to happen for the next 40 minutes. We're going to be jumping here, there and everywhere. It won't be necessarily chronological.
That's all right. Don't worry. Yeah. Hope we don't bore the nation.
No, I doubt that we will. Now, the house you were born in, a little cottage with a
Tin roof.
Mm. Yeah.
And there's a lovely picture of it in the book. And funnily enough, the number of people who have said, gosh, that's a gorgeous picture. And my father's basically lying against the outside of it. And my mother, God be good to her, and my youngest sister, Joan, in the door of the house, and they're bigger than the door of the house, which was the normal way, and there were small windows, and of course people built that way because they had no central heating, so they didn't put big windows in to let the heating out, because there was no double glazing or anything at that stage. So we had a lovely big hearth fire on one side of the kitchen, and everybody gathered around that. It was a cement floor. And there was a wireless. We were lucky enough to have a big wireless in the corner, a Murphy Richards wireless, one of those big things in the corner that had Arth Loan on it. There was no RTE. Arth Loan was on that. And you'd be swiddling this to get it right, but it was really, that was precisely it. That's a great sound, the sound of my youth. That. And then all of a sudden you'd get, this is Radio Luxembourg 208 on the dial. And that was just excellent when you got to that stage.
And then on a Sunday afternoon, I would imagine you'd all, particularly during the summer, you'd all gather around to hear the great Michael O'Hare.
That was exactly it.
We have a couple of clips here.
Ah, have you? Well, he was the greatest broadcaster. I got to know him very well afterwards, and it was a lovely, lovely man, me and Molly, his wife. Both of them were lovely, lovely people. And it was, he talked to me one day during 1984, which was the centenary of the GAA, and he said, Brian, would you say a prayer that one of the All Ireland's this year is a draw, because if it is, I will reach my 100th All Ireland in the centenary of the GAA.
Did it happen?
It didn't happen.
All right.
He got a stroke beforehand.
Oh.
The Whitford man sends a high ball well up the field. Oh, a delightful piece of holding there. Holding of the ball by Len Gaynor. Passing it up now to Liam Devaney. Liam Devaney trying to get room to swing his stick. He just can't. Vincent Staples is after him. But he gets his puck in. Well in towards the goal mouth. Quickly blocks it down. And it's a goal!
I'm with you there.
Oh, isn't that fantastic?
Yes.
Isn't that fantastic? Greatest commentator ever, because that was before we had any pictures of anything. He had to create the pictures.
Of
and
course.
You know, at the very beginning of that, they had in 1937, was it? Monaghan was one of the first things he broadcast. And there was a priest used to broadcast.
It was 1938.
38, wasn't
and
it?
And he was 18.
Yeah.
And he commentated when Galway defeated Monaghan in
All-Ireland
football semi-final.
That's right, Yeah. Before that, it was a priest used to do it.
Okay.
Apparently. And they used to divide the field in segments. So the ball now is in segment two, and segment three,
right,
segment
okay.
four. Because
you've lost me already.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
Because everybody knew segment one. Was
there, yes.
And, one segment, and that was how they, before Michael O'Hare came, but he came in, he pretends to go right, goes left. You know, we had all his phrases, and you'd go out in the field and you'd bang the ball against the turf house door, and you'd be doing exactly what he had said.
Yeah,
it's just wonderful.
You were sporty enough, your dad played for Fermanagh, and you were good, handy enough at football.
I was a good Gaelic footballer, all right. I played county minors for Fermanagh. But Fermanagh usually got beat in the first round, so only I'd got played once. to get playing once is a kind of it was, very good.
You're in a small club, you're a county player, even if it was Fermanagh.
It was Fermanagh, exactly.
And what sort of, before we get to that age, what sort of a child were you?
I think I was a terribly normal child. I was an inquisitive child. I would ask questions a lot, and I was interested in conversations. Our house was a house with a turf fire and seats around the turf fire, and there was an open door. There was a half door in the house, and we were on the side of the road, and everybody came in for tea. And there was always a kettle on this crook of the thing boiling, and my mother would make endless mugs of tea, and of course the mugs of tea at that stage, there was no tea bags, it had to be stewed in a pot, and you split a coal and you stewed a thing on the pot on the split coal, and you'd see it bubbling, and you didn't pour it until it bubbled.
Yes,
you know, so it was very strong.
And and you say in the book that she ran a sort of an informal confessional.
She did. She did. Well, it was, everybody came in and everybody spoke to her. Now, when it got a bit dicey, when you knew it was getting good, when you were asked, go out inside and play. I have that feeling when the story's getting good in confession. You know, I'm looking around just telling somebody to go out and get play.
That's your memory of childhood, yeah.
That's the memory of it. And everybody knew exactly, Protestants, Catholics, it didn't matter. We were in a mixed area, Protestant area, but we were in a mixed area. And that was part of life. You know, Catholics were second-class citizens, and we knew that. But nobody made us feel that. We accepted
it. It was the 50s, yeah.
Well, we accepted
it. It hadn't come to a head yet.
And
at that
11 search. Plus was the difference.
Yeah. Now, talk to me about 11 plus, because in Ballinalech, the local school hadn't got a great record in getting pupils through the 11 plus.
No, it hadn't.
So you were sent off to where?
I was sent off to Oma, my aunt in Oma.
Right.
Donnelly's in Oma. Great football house too. Two of them played for Tyrone. Buried one of them 2 weeks ago. Sean, my first cousin. God be good to him. And it was a great football house. And my aunt had a big family of her own, but she also had 10 boarders. It was a lodging house,
right,
just beside the courthouse. And you'd have everybody from visiting judges and things like that coming into the house. And she came up one day to our house in Fermanagh, my mother and her were sisters. And she said, look, that boy needs manners put on him. That's me.
Yeah.
And she said, I think if we had him in Oma, we'd get him through the 11 plus, because her son was a teacher in Oma. And we'd get him through the 11 plus. That fella's smart enough to get through the 11 plus. My father said, well, he's never going to pass the 11 plus here, because it wasn't a tradition.
It was an entry exam into secondary school.
If you, at the 11 plus, if you did, it's still going on, unfortunately, to get into a grammar school. And if you got that, you got free education, and you got free travel, and you got free books.
Right.
If you didn't
very
do that,
important.
Very important. And if you didn't do it, and it also had, if you went through the grammar school, you then had an opportunity for university. So up until...
Change your life, yeah.
Just changed everything. Now, it was the hardest thing that I ever did, I suppose, in many ways, because at 8-year-old, 9-year-old, my father, on a Sunday evening, put me on the bar of his bicycle, rode 5 miles into the railway station, there was a railway station, and put me on the train with a little bag and a coat on me. And I can still see myself, that innocent fella, going on that train, puff, puff, puff and train, down to Oma. It took it nearly an hour to go to Oma. I got off the train in Oma, and you'd be looking to see, don't miss the station. What'll happen if I miss the station? What'll happen at the end in Derry? Do you know what I mean? And then I get out of that Sunday night, walk up in the dark through the streets of Oma to my aunt, most of whom would be bed, and I go up to my little room and do my home exercise for Monday morning, get up then early the next morning and go to 8:30 mass. And then you come back and you'd set the table for all these breakfasts, because we didn't have the money to pay for it. And so I felt that I had a duty to do something to pay for my keep.
Pay your way, yeah.
Pay my way. Yeah. So I would wash dishes and set the table. And that's why I felt I had done something then. Friday evening then was the dead opposite. You were all happy getting home.
And I said there, and this is the serious part of the book, I said there that getting the 11 plus was life-changing, but going to school in that school in Oman was life-changing for you as well.
In a very different way altogether. It got some lovely things in it, and I got a future that I wouldn't have had, so let's understand that, and that's due to the brothers who told me. But at the same time, that's where I discovered that the world isn't as nice as I thought it was, because I was easy to pick out. I was from the country going into a town, you know. I was from Fermanagh going into Tyrone. I was lost in a schoolyard of fellas who all knew and grew up with each other, and I was outsider. And a brother picked me out as a vulnerable person. And then, of course, he used to bring me up to the empty classroom and put me across his knee. And I don't want to go into any more details about it, but it was, I didn't know what it was, but I knew it was wrong. I knew it was very wrong. I knew that I was partaking in this. And how can I tell this in confession? What can I tell? Am I worthy to receive the Blessed Eucharist after that? If what happens if my mother or my aunt finds out about this? And, you know, it was an extraordinary, I'd lie awake at night, you know, I'd lie awake at night trying to think what will happen if that, how can I avoid him tomorrow? It went on for quite some time. In my mind, I don't know how long it went on for, but it went on for not every day, but certainly once or twice a week for a best part of a year.
And you were 10?
Just 10. Going on 3. Four. Yes. You understand? I mean, a country cub in that time. And a cub is a young fella in our country.
It is horrific how abusers can spot a person like you were, that 9, 10 year old, who was vulnerable, away from home,
lonely, outsider, not likely to tell anybody.
I wonder, would he be sitting there looking at loads of people and just, how would he, I'm sure you've gone through your head, why did he pick you?
I've dealt with so many abusers since in my time, and I still don't know the mind. Yeah. But all I do know is that they have a radar to spot the vulnerable child, the vulnerable person, and it's a radar to do it. I don't know, it just breaks my heart when I think about it.
In the book, I spotted words that you use, and you've written it yourself.
Yes, or every word.
And there was telltale words.
Thanks, Ray. What are they?
But I recognise a bit of myself in you, in that I'm a worrier and you are a worrier.
Yes, definitely.
You mentioned, this is funny, that when you were going on your summer holidays to Bundoran,
yes,
you were so excited that you got physically sick.
Physically sick, and they wouldn't tell me.
Yes, so you were a nervy sort of child.
I was nervy.
Even before
excitable,
this happened.
Excitable.
Even before this happened.
That happened. But you see, I think that's part of the, you know, I suppose I was a child who wanted to be loved. Do you understand what I mean?
Yes.
Wanted to be liked. Because my father was a very popular man in the area as a popular footballer, and you felt that you had to be liked and you had to do that. I was an altar server. I was all of that. And you learned your prayers because that's what you're supposed to do. You know, and I could still say the Apostles' Creed that I knew even then at that stage, you know. And you would learn that, and you wanted to be right, because that's the way you were brought up. You know, do your best. Do your best.
My people pleaser.
You're a total people pleaser.
Yes.
Yes. And that was regarded as a good thing.
Yes.
You know, nowadays a people pleaser can be spotted a bit different often as a people pleaser. And I had to unlearn that just very quickly as later in life, because I became a superior in a monastery. And again, you could be manipulated if you're a people pleaser as a superior. So I had to, you know, I had to learn how to change and be different. But it was an awful period of time which haunts me to this day.
I'm going to put the two of them together there so we can move on. So that was when you were 9, 10. And then you went to the seminary and you ended up down in Dublin in Mount Argus.
Yes.
And at the age of 18, you were abused again.
Yes. Again. I entered at 17 and then at 18 was my first year in university. And I was abused again, this time within the monastery by one of the priests that I had joined. You know, and it was... it didn't take me as long to spot it that time. He had spotted me as a thin, gaunt young fella that didn't want to be at university because I didn't think it was good enough, being sent to university, struggling at university in that first year to find a way of managing with a different system. I'd grown up in the north. I was down in UCD, and it was the southern system, and it was Irish, and it was Latin, and it was all of those things. And I was struggling, really struggling, and very lonely, very, very lonely, and wondering, had I made the right decision? having committed myself at that stage to a vow of celibacy, of obedience and poverty, and had committed myself to that, and, you know, wondering, was I living it properly? Mm. Wondering, was I doing everything properly? And it was just this worrying thing. And again, it was spotted. And he had asked a senior student, he said, "That young fella looks like the caring fella. I'm sick today. Would you send him up to look after me?" And it was all official.
It was sort of cold though, because did the senior pupils know what was going on, do you think? Yeah, you don't know.
To be honest, I don't know.
No.
Most of them are dead now.
Yes.
And only recently, this is not in the book, more recent than the book, a person who had read the book who was in one of in the monastery at that time, long left it now. He came to him and he said, you know, I think more than you than let on. And that has
that
put
hurts,
me back.
Doesn't it?
Oh God, does that hurt? Does that hurt? That anybody would allow that, you know, that to happen. So anyway, sure, I survived it.
Here's the thing, Brian, because you said there again that you were unworthy. And again, little words in the book. Hmm. It's a recurring thing that you felt you were unworthy and low self-esteem and inferiority complex. You mentioned all these things over and over again.
Yes.
Now, I'm intrigued to know, was that you in your genes, or was it as a result of the abuse?
My reading of it, Ray, is this. This is not an official reading. It's just my reading of it. As people can differ on it. My reading is that it was in a little bit of it was in the genes, because, you know, you were a Catholic in a Protestant area and you were all of that.
Yes.
And all of that was in part of the thing of growing up. And you didn't think you were worthy to, didn't think you were worthy of an education, didn't you? Any of that. You didn't. And then, of course, the church that I belonged to, that still belonged to at the time, was, you know, what is the last thing you say before you go to communion? Lord, I am not worthy.
Right.
And of course, we're not. So that word worthy was recurring, and psychologically recurring as well. So all of that was difficult to cope with. And I still think I'm not worthy.
Worthy of what?
I'm 50 years old.
Congratulations.
In 2 weeks' time.
Yeah.
And people would say to me, "Are you going to have a celebration?" I'd say, no, God, I'm not going to celebrate it. I could have. Look at what the church has done to people. Why would I be celebrating what priests have done to people? Mm. You can't do that. And I would feel it wouldn't be right for me to do it, you know.
But you can celebrate what you have done for people in this country, Brian.
But sure, I leave that to the man above, you know, of what I've done for people. I don't know what I've done for people. I've tried to be honest. I've tried to tell them that God loves them. I've tried to tell them that they're good people. And I've tried to tell them that all of this nonsense about laws and regulations is nothing to do with God. Mm. And there's a current theme in the book, which you may have got, is that nobody can stop me loving God if I want to. No church, no law. And nobody can stop God loving me at all.
Yeah. Because I don't know if anybody in the, is it the Cura they call it?
Curia.
Curia. I don't know if anybody in the Curia has read the book yet.
No. They only read the Sunday World there. According to the...
Because you're very, very critical of the structure of the Catholic Church in the book.
Yes,
very,
yes,
very. Like your criticism is damning.
Is
in
it
the
too
book.
Much?
It's not for me to say, Brian, at all. Yeah, you know, because you know how I stand on that. So it's not for me to say.
Yeah, yeah.
But
but as a reader, would you say it's too tough, or is it tougher?
I think it's fair. I think it's very fair.
I would thought so. Yeah.
Well, because I think you're a fair man.
Yes. Yes. Well, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. But you don't. Are you fearless now about them? Because they've tried to silence you in the past.
Yeah. Exactly. And that, I suppose, that sort of made me change greatly, because the abuse did that to me, and I gave my life very, very dedicatedly to the church things, always. Could have got married maybe, you know, at some stage, and a different life was beckoning. I was a reasonable broadcaster. I could have had a life as a broadcaster.
Yes.
As a reasonable journalist, I could have had a life as a journalist. As a reasonable showband manager, I could have had a life as a showband manager.
Multi-talented.
But, yeah.
You've just given your CV there now.
All the boys in the band used to say to me, "You're wasting your time as a priest. You should be managing the band." Sometimes they probably were right. But
so you've given an awful lot of yourself to the church.
I have, and I don't regret that. First of all, I gave it to the church. church, right? That's the bit I'm going with it. First of all, I gave it to the church. Then I decided that the church didn't want me. Well, I didn't decide that. They decided that. That they were saying that I was a danger to people, that I was a heretic, that I was causing scandal by telling the truth. And they said the abuse thing came back on me at that stage. And that was the church abusing me again. And it took me, that really floored me. I mean, I could have crawled up and died, and I was close enough to having suicidal thoughts at that stage, I have to say. And I recognised them as suicidal thoughts, and I tried to change myself, you know, don't let that happen to you. And then through a process and through friends.
And this is only in the last 10 years or so, isn't it?
Less than 10, less, yeah. And so I had to rethink myself, and eventually I had to say, listen, come here a minute now. You're allowing them to re-abuse you. And you shouldn't do that. You should be in control of your own life. And you have to take your own life. Yeah. And you have to accept it. And what's important and what's not important. What happens in Rome in the institutions of the church has no value to me now.
And people are listening to you. And this is exactly what you said. I'm going to say it back to you.
Right.
You've said it less than a minute ago.
Right.
Here they are abusing me again.
Ah, that's right.
That's what you just said.
Yes, and that's right.
And then that begs the question, why in all those 50 years did you not just walk away? And there's a quote from you in the book,
right,
from a Father McElroy. He says, it takes a good man to enter, aye, but it takes even a better man to walk away.
Yeah. Yeah,
is it talking about the priesthood?
Yeah, well, you see, at several times, for different reasons, I began to, because mostly I thought I was unworthy to be a priest anyway. And then I began to say, well, look, it's not about you. Would you, for God's sake, grow up? So whether I'm worthy or not is immaterial. Priesthood isn't about me. It's about God
And there's no questioning your pastoral work in any way, shape or form, because it's exemplary. You have a book signing tomorrow in Easton's in Monaghan at 11 o'clock.
That's right.
Easton's Monaghan, 11 o'clock. Okay, and that's you'll be there. How long are you doing Pause for Thought on BBC Two?
They have me booked in for the 13th of January on a Monday morning, and that's to mark the fact that it will be 30 years completed.
Wow.
It's the longest on it. I started off with Derek Jamieson.
Yes, American.
Yes, exactly. And as I often say, the big difficulty with Derek was, Derek was quite a nice man to broadcast with, but the point was, every time you mentioned God, he looked up because I think he thought you were talking about him. And then I had Brian Hayes. It was quite the opposite, you know. Brian just hid himself, wouldn't look at you. Then I had Sarah Kennedy, who was absolutely gorgeous. And then luckily I had Terry,
yes,
and I had 16 years of Terry, followed by 8 glorious years. Terry was just, he was just the greatest.
And you became close.
Oh, very, very, very. He was a real mentor and a real lovely, lovely man. Couldn't speak highly enough of Terry Wogan.
Did you have the chance, not to bring it back to the abuse, but would he have known about that? He would have.
Yeah. He would have known about it. But Terry would be the man who would skate away from
Which is probably yeah.
And then Chris
Evans,
Chris is just, I was afraid of Chris because he was, you know, wild, you know. But he turned out to be a really lovely man to brought. Couldn't believe in the same things I believe in, but utterly, utterly interested in everything about how to improve yourself, how to be a better person, how to be a better human being, how to do things, and he'd still be a very good friend.
He wrote a brilliant piece on running. You must read it. You look it up. I can't remember. I think it was for the Sunday Times magazine.
I must look at him.
Because he's a big marathon runner now.
He is now.
But he was driving home one day and he saw a lake, and I won't. But you should read it. It's a lovely piece.
Yeah.
And now it's Zoe Ball.
And now it's Zoe. Zoe's much more quiet, you know, and she's very affirming. Zoe's extremely affirming. So, but there's all of that personality. It's just a different era in broadcasting.
Yes,
that's all it is, which I'm getting used to now. But I suppose at 30 years broadcasting, I'm not so
that's
sure.
Amazing how long ago. It's an amazing record. And the Sunday World.
I'm going into my 1976. I'm going into my 43rd. I'm completed it. I'm in my 44th.
Wow.